You see that black boy over there running scared, his old man in a bottle. He done quit his 9 to 5, he drink full time, and now he's living in a bottle. See that black boy over there running scared, his old man got a problem, and it's a bad one. He ain't done fond of damn near everything, his old woman waiting to pay for bottom.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just tuning into this broadcast, we're listening to Do Guns Reduce Crime?
My question is for those who are in favor of the proposition. Isn't there a distinction between a handgun and a more excessive weapon like an AK-47?
Is an AK-47 something that people should have a right to carry around in, on the same terms as a handgun? Stephen Halpern, who represents the NRA.
The Second Amendment protects the right to keep and bear arms, and the question is what kinds of arms are constitutionally protected. And the Supreme Court just addressed that in the Heller case and said that handguns are commonly possessed by law-abiding citizens historically for lawful purposes. The term AK-47 is very ambiguous. If it means a real AK-47, that means a fully automatic machine gun. They're very highly restricted in this country. They have to be registered with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. But that's really never where the debate has been. The debate has always been, for example, the Brady Center supporting the D.C. handgun ban. What people are concerned about is the ability to have a normal kind of gun in their house to protect themselves and to have rifles, pistols, and shotguns for sporting purposes or other lawful purposes. Real AK-47s, I don't know of anybody who advocates deregulating them under current federal law, which is very strict.
Steve, didn't you file something with the Supreme Court arguing that the machine gun ban was unconstitutional? I mean, you've argued that machine guns should be allowed, right?
This whole thing is really a red herring.
Let Stephen answer that. Okay. That was a question to Stephen.
Right. The National Firearms Act, passed in 1934, provides that certain kinds of highly restricted firearms can be registered and possessed by law-abiding citizens who go through these extreme background checks. And if you were to pass a ban on any kind of gun, it does raise questions under the Second Amendment as well as the Interstate Commerce Clause. There was a Supreme Court where we raised that issue. We did not argue that machine guns were protected by the Second Amendment. We argued that a constitutional issue is raised by whether they should be banned or not, and it's something that it had to do with a statutory interpretation. It's not a case that was a Second Amendment case. The only Second Amendment case the Supreme Court has dealt with is the Heller case, and it's decided that the kinds of guns that we're all ordinarily talking about here, rifles, pistols, and handguns are the ones that are, rifles, shotguns, and handguns are the ones that are constitutionally protected. These other issues are red herrings.
I want to point out where we are at this point. We've wrapped up the head-to-head section, and we are at the point, approaching the point where we need all of you to make the decision that decides how this evening ends. Let's to remind you, when you came in and we polled you on the motion, guns reduce crime, 13% of you agreed, 60% of you disagreed, and 27% were undecided. We have heard the bulk of the arguments and the back and forth, but now we're going to allow each panelist to sum up his position, beginning with the Seattle Chief of Police, Gil Kerlikowske.
John Locke told you that, well, people with concealed firearms rarely commit murders. Guess what? People that go through some type of check and go through a police department to get their concealed firearms permit don't go out and commit a lot of crimes. I can tell you that people with concealed firearms permits drive drunk with the gun in their holster in their car. People with concealed firearms permits, in which we sent a clerk home because she issued one on a Monday, and on Friday when she was filing reports saw that the person had, after getting the permit, committed suicide with the gun within the same week. And one of our young women officers who talked a drunken woman out of a gun who was holding it to her head and her face and in her lap and finally was able to wrestle it away had just gotten her concealed firearms permits. I think reasonableness should enter into this. It should be more than just being upright and not being blind to allow you to carry a gun.
Thank you. Chief Kerlikowske of Seattle Chief of Police speaking against the motion. Speaking for the motion in his summarizing statement, John Lott, Senior Research Scholar at the University of Maryland.
You know, there are lots of things that affect crime, but we can deal with numbers on a lot of these things. We have anecdotal stories. The police chief just went through some. I advise you, you can go and check these things out. The Florida Department of issuing these concealed handgun permits has detailed records. You can go to their website. They'll go through year by year and tell you how many permit holders have been convicted for driving under the influence of alcohol. And it's an incredibly tiny number. The rate at which people lose their permits for any type of firearms-related violation, he gave examples of that, state after state, is hundreds or thousands of one percentage point. And I want to respond to John Donahue's comments about D.C. It's not true whether you look at rates, you look at numbers, that you're going to see the murder rates fall or robbery rates fall after D.C.'s handgun ban. It goes up in either case. It just goes up more with the rate. And what when he says it falls, what happens is when you're just looking at the numbers, the numbers are falling quickly before the ban and rising relatively slowly after. And what he does is compare the before average and the after average, and that makes it look like the before average is higher than the after average. So it looks like, well, it's falling, but it's just the average. If you look at year by year, you see it's falling slowly and then rising faster afterwards.
Summarizing his position against the motion, John Donahue, economist and professor of law at Yale.
There are many features of the United States that would suggest we'd have one of the lowest rates of violent crime. Rich countries in general have low rates of violent crime. We're the richest. We have more people in prison than any other country in world history. Yet our crime rate is phenomenally high, and you hear the proposition is that more guns would reduce crime. We have 42% of the world's guns in civilian hands in the United States. How many more would we need to get down to the level of crime of our European allies? They mentioned Switzerland and Israel. Again, these are completely inapposite. Switzerland has a regime in which individuals are in a militia. They take home an assault weapon, and they are given a locked container of ammunition that they're not allowed to open up. They have to repeatedly come to headquarters and show that they haven't opened it up, and if they have, they're put in jail. In Israel, they do put you in jail if you lose your gun. This is the problem. They keep ignoring the fact that between 500,000 and a million guns are stolen every year. That means a gun in a criminal's hands. Even if it's keeping you epsilon safer by having a gun, when your gun gets turned over a criminal, that's making everybody else more unsafe.
Thank you, John Donahue. Summing up his position for the motion, Guns Reduce Crime, Stephen Halbrook, attorney representing the NRA in several lawsuits.
Thank you, John. I want to respond to two things that Professor Donahue has stated. In the Heller case, the Supreme Court decided that the Second Amendment guarantees the individual right of individual citizens to keep and bear arms, including handguns. That's the position that the NRA has taken for many, many decades of its history, since 1871. And Mr. Donahue said that the NRA does not tell the truth on the Second Amendment. Well, then the Supreme Court doesn't either, because that's what the Supreme Court held in the Heller case. In addition, I've been to Switzerland many times and participated in shooting matches with military rifles, and you can buy all the ammunition you want at the shooting ranges and at gun shops. You're issued a tin of ammunition that you're not allowed to open because they want it to be available if the militia army has to be mobilized. But there's no restriction on your ammunition usage. Every Swiss male, when he enters age 20, is issued a military assault rifle, and he keeps it at home. The remaining thought I would like to say in favor of the proposition is I would like everybody to kind of think about yourself. You've heard here tonight that we're all potential murderers, that if we get angry, if we have a gun, we're going to kill somebody. It's just not true. Most people with these concealed weapon permits are just like you and me. They're normal people. They don't just suddenly get angry or have a couple glasses of wine and go on murderous sprees.
Summing up his position against the motion, Guns Reduce Crime, Paul Helmke, president of the Brady Campaign and Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence.
The question you have to ask yourself is, did the other side prove its case? Did they prove that guns reduce crime? You haven't really heard any evidence to show that it did. And I think the question you should ask yourself to just get a gut check on this is, when you're at the next sporting event, when you're sitting in the restaurant, would you feel safer thinking that everyone had a gun or that no one had a gun? The reason you react that way is because you know instinctively that we make it too easy for dangerous people and people that don't know the responsibilities that go with guns to get guns. I ask the question, why aren't we the safest country in the world if we've got so many guns? It's because we make it too easy. We don't know where those guns are. We don't know who has the guns. Where do the guns come from that the bad guys, that the gang members get? They steal them from people like you. They steal them from gun stores who lose 30,000 guns every year. They get them through straw purchases. There are no limits on the number of guns you can buy at one time. There are very few limits on the type of guns you can buy. In most places in this country, there really are no laws. We make it too easy for dangerous people to get guns. The way to reduce crime is to do things like background checks, fight the illegal trafficking in guns, say that some guns should not be in the hands of the civilian population. Those are things that can help take down the crime rates in our communities, not flooding our communities with more guns. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Paul Helmke. And our final speaker, as we approach the moment of truth, speaking for the motion, Guns Reduce Crime, Gary Kleck, Professor of Criminology and Criminal Justice at Florida State.
You may remember I started out my opening remarks by saying you sometimes need to listen for the silences, and I think the panelists on the other side demonstrated that because they didn't, in fact, address the evidence that we presented. We cited some of the most thoroughly vetted scientific evidence we have on the question. Study after study repeatedly showed the same thing. It showed defensive gun use is common. It showed defensive gun use is effective. It's also a sign of a weakness of a particular position when people have to misstate what the issue is. Remember, the proposition was that guns reduce crime. Okay, do they make you safer to have a gun? Well, we didn't really hear anything about that. Instead, we hear Paul Helmke saying, would you feel comfortable with everybody having a gun? Well, of course, that's not the issue. Nobody here proposed that because, of course, everybody includes lunatics, convicted murderers, robbers, rapists, and so on. It's not the proposition. And in fact, no one here even secretly thinks that we ought to do that. It's not an issue. So why not confront the issue? Do guns reduce crime? Well, in fact, guns in the hands of non-criminals, guns in the hands of crime victims do make them safer.
That was Gary Kleck. Thank you. Now we are at the moment of truth. The results. Before the debate, 13% were for the motion, 60% were against, and 27% were undecided. After the debate, the side for the motion moved more of you. 27% agree with the motion that guns reduce crime, 64% of you disagree, and now only 10% of you are undecided. So it was a close call with a little bit of an edge to those for the motion in terms of moving and changing minds. Congratulations to all of our panelists.
Hear great speeches and interviews at Access Sacramento every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m. or go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
I don't like words that hide the truth. I don't like words that conceal reality. I don't like euphemisms or euphemistic language. And American English is loaded with euphemisms because Americans have a lot of trouble dealing with reality. Americans have trouble facing the truth. So they invent a kind of a soft language to protect themselves from it. And it gets worse with every generation. For some reason, it just keeps getting worse. I'll give you an example of that. There's a condition in combat. Most people know about it. It's when a fighting person's nervous system has been stressed to its absolute peak and maximum, can't take any more input. The nervous system has either snapped or is about to snap. In the First World War, that condition was called shell shock. Simple, honest, direct language. Two syllables. Shell shock. Almost sounds like the guns themselves. That was 70 years ago. Then a whole generation went by, and the Second World War came along, and the very same combat condition was called battle fatigue. Four syllables now. Takes a little longer to say. Doesn't seem to hurt as much. Fatigue is a nicer word than shock. Shell shock. Battle fatigue. Then we had the war in Korea, 1950. Madison Avenue was riding high by that time. And the very same combat condition was called operational exhaustion. Hey, we're up to eight syllables now. And the humanity has been squeezed completely out of the phrase. It's totally sterile now. Operational exhaustion. Sounds like something that might happen to your car. Then, of course, came the war in Vietnam, which has only been over for about 16 or 17 years. And thanks to the lies and deceit surrounding that war, I guess it's no surprise that the very same condition was called post-traumatic stress disorder. Still eight syllables, but we've added a hyphen. And the pain is completely buried under jargon. Post-traumatic stress disorder. I'll bet you, if we'd have still been calling it shell shock, some of those Vietnam veterans might have gotten the attention they needed at the time. I'll bet you that. But it didn't happen. And one of the reasons is because we were using that soft language, that language that takes the life out of life. And it is a function of time. It does keep getting worse. I'll give you another example. Sometime during my life, toilet paper became bathroom tissue. I wasn't notified of this. No one asked me if I agreed with it. It just happened. Toilet paper became bathroom tissue. Sneakers became running shoes. False teeth became dental appliances. medicine became medication. Information became directory assistance. The dump became the landfill. Car crashes became automobile accidents. Partly cloudy became partly sunny. Motels became motor lodges. House trailers became mobile homes. Used cars became previously owned transportation. Room service became guest room dining. And constipation became occasional irregularity. When I was a little kid, if I got sick, they wanted me to go to the hospital and see the doctor. Now they want me to go to a health maintenance organization or a wellness center to consult a healthcare delivery professional. Poor people used to live in slums. Now the economically disadvantaged occupy substandard housing in the inner cities. And they're broke. They're broke. They don't have a negative cash flow position. They're fucking broke. Because a lot of them were fired. You know, fired. Management wanted to curtail redundancies in the human resources area. So many people are no longer viable members of the workforce. Smug, greedy, well-fed white people have invented a language to conceal their sins. It's as simple as that. The CIA doesn't kill anybody anymore. They neutralize people. Or they depopulate the area. The government doesn't lie. It engages in disinformation. The Pentagon actually measures nuclear radiation in something they call sunshine units. Israeli murderers are called commandos. Arab commandos are called terrorists. Contra killers are called freedom fighters. Well, if crime fighters fight crime and firefighters fight fire, what do freedom fighters fight? They never mention that part of it to us, do they? Never mention that part of it. And... And some of this stuff is just silly. We all know that. Like on the airlines, they say they want a pre-board. Well, what the hell is pre-board? What does that mean? To get on before you get on? They say they're going to pre-board those passengers in need of special assistance. Cripples! Simple, honest, direct language. There's no shame attached to the word cripple that I can find in any dictionary. No shame attached to it. In fact, it's a word used in Bible translations. Jesus healed the cripples. Doesn't take seven words to describe that condition. But we don't have any cripples in this country anymore. We have the physically challenged. Is that a grotesque enough evasion for you? How about differently abled? I've heard them called that. Differently abled. You can't even call these people handicapped anymore. They'll say, we're not handicapped, we're handicapable. These poor people have been bullshitted by the system into believing that if you change the name of the condition, somehow you'll change the condition. Well, hey, cousin, doesn't happen. Doesn't happen. We have no more deaf people in this country, hearing impaired. No one's blind anymore, partially sighted or visually impaired. We have no more stupid people. Everybody has a learning disorder. Or he's minimally exceptional. How would you like to be told that about your child? He's minimally exceptional. Oh, thank God for that. Psychologists actually have started calling ugly people those with severe appearance deficits. It's getting so bad that any day now I expect to hear a rape victim referred to as an unwilling sperm recipient. You know? And we have no more old people in this country. No more old people. We shipped them all away, and we brought in these senior citizens. Isn't that a typically American 20th century phrase? Bloodless, lifeless. No pulse in one of them. A senior citizen. But I've accepted that when I've come to terms with it. I know it's here to stay. We'll never get rid of it. That's what they're going to be called, so I'll relax on that. But the one I do resist, the one I keep resisting, is when they look at an old guy and they'll say, look at him, Dan. He's 90 years young. Imagine the fear of aging that reveals. To not even be able to use the word old to describe someone, to have to use an antonym. And fear of aging is natural, it's universal, isn't it? We all have that. No one wants to get old, no one wants to die, but we do. So we bullshit ourselves. I started bullshitting myself when I got to my 40s. Soon as I was in my 40s, I'd look in the mirror and I'd say, well, I guess I'm getting older. Older sounds a little better than old, doesn't it? Sounds like it might even last a little longer. Bullshit, I'm getting old. And it's okay, because thanks to our fear of death in this country, I won't have to die. I'll pass away. Or I'll expire like a magazine subscription. If it happens in the hospital, they'll call it a terminal episode. The insurance company will refer to it as negative patient care outcome. And if it's the result of malpractice, they'll say it was a therapeutic misadventure. I'm telling you, some of this language makes me want to vomit. Well, maybe not vomit. Makes me want to engage in an involuntary personal protein spill.
Oh. Oh, God. Ooh. Oh, God. Oh. 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 Oh, God. Oh, yeah, right there. Oh. 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 Oh, God. Oh. Yes. 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 I'll have what she's having.
And now for something completely different.